There is a most fascinating conversation which is taking place on this day here as the Club Baldai continues to meet. You know, we've been having lots of conversations about multipolarity and the actions, or maybe the would-be actions, that are going to be taking place in that part of the world that used to view itself as being on the outside. But what about that part of the world which has often been referred to as the unipolar world? What are going to be the actions moving forward of countries like the UK, other countries perhaps, and in Europe, and of course the magdaddy of them all, my country, the United States of America? What needs to be done in these places? You know, it's interesting because I have found, and many of us who were here this morning who attended one of the discussions found, that there's an argument that's being made which is causing some kind of conflictive reaction over what the role is of the United States and whether the United States really needs to change anything at all. That point was made today in one of the seminars, and it didn't necessarily go without notice, shall we say. We're going to talk about that, as we are a lot of other things, including one particular comment that just came out of the UK, which is riling a lot of people up. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm glad to say that, alas, it's not rainy, it's not foggy, we're not inside of a cloud. It's actually quite a beautiful day here at this Valdai Club, which is held in this part, not far from Sochi, which is one of the most beautiful beaches and also one of the most picturesque places in the world. But one of the reasons that so many intellectuals come here once a year to have these discussions is to kind of hammer out differences from time to time, some of the things they agree on, and some of the things that they generally don't like. Now, if there's an antithesis to this gathering of people who attempt at least to try and work things out, there's the other side. There are those people in the world who are trying to be as conflictive as they possibly can. And by golly, do I have a perfect example of that. It's almost like it was fed to us. This is something that happened, interestingly enough, about 3-4 hours ago is when we received it, when I got a notification on my phone that I had to watch what this person had just said. Now, let me tell you who this is as we get ready to start the show. This is a gentleman who used to be the Secretary of State for Defense in the UK. And he has come out and made a statement, which sounds to my ears anyway, like he is trying his best to instigate a war with Russia. His words are extremely aggressive. I'll let you be the judge. Listen to what Mr. Wallace says about what he thinks should happen from a very aggressive standpoint toward Russia. Here it is.
So we have to help Ukraine have the long-range capabilities to make Crimea unviable. We need to choke the life out of Crimea. And I think if we do that, I think Putin will realize he's got something to lose. If it is not inhabitable or not possible for it to function, and that bridge, we need Taurus in from Germany. We need to smash the Kursk bridge, because that's an ego, that's a statue to Putin's ego.
And that's really just the beginning of this. But there's been, in the last 24 hours, a lot of aggressive language, shall we say, about Russia in particular. You heard what he just said, and I think you can draw your own conclusions. It seemed to me like it was a very aggressive statement. It seems to me like he's instigating a war with Russia. But I have some much smarter people than I am who are going to be joining us in just a bit to kind of diagnose that for us. I want to bring you something else now. This is Donald Tusk. This is the Prime Minister of Poland. And interestingly enough, he, Mr. Tusk, has been very, very forthright lately in defense of Poland, which is his right, obviously. But he's trying to make this point and trying to get all of Europe behind him that Russia has this massive plan any day now to invade Poland. All of this, for those of you who've been following this, there have been some errant drones that somehow came close to the Polish border. And he has been making the argument that it was something which was done by the Russian military purposely. There's no hard evidence to suggest that, but nonetheless, he's been running with that narrative. Here is his latest. This is Donald Tusk, Poland. Here's his latest salvo.
Jest wojna.
It is war.
It is the biggest and most important task for all opinion leaders today is to make other people realize in depth, profoundly, that goes in the depths of people's minds and their hearts. We should make Western societies and transatlantic society, we must make them aware this is war. We didn't want it. Unwanted war. Sometimes strange, a new type of war. But this is war. We don't want to sacrifice the lives of our soldiers. We need to realize it's not about loving Ukraine. It's not about bad or good experiences related to history which involve Ukraine. It's a question about solidarity that was attacked by an aggressor. It's a question about security, safety, and the possibility of Western civilization to survive.
There's something else, though, because not all of the comments are coming from an anti-Russia standpoint. I want to share another one with you now. This is Viktor Orban within the last 24 hours, who's also put out a reaction. And this is the type of palaver that's going back and forth now in most parts of Europe. Very Russia-centric, by the way. He says, and this is an answer to Donald Tusk, and essentially an answer to Mr. Wallace as well, the UK gentleman who seems like he was trying to instigate a war with Russia. Again, this is Viktor Orban, Hungarian Prime Minister. I quote, "You may think," he writes, "that you are at war with Russia, but Hungary is not. Neither is the European Union. You are playing a dangerous game," says Viktor Orban, "a dangerous game with the lives and the security of millions of Europeans." And then he finishes this post that he has just put out by saying, "This is very bad." That's Viktor Orban. So that sets the table for where we are. Throughout the week, we haven't spoken much about this particular schism that has seemingly been taking place for quite some time. But given these comments that have just taken place in the last 24 hours, I thought it would be instructive for us to start our discussion with that. Let me tell you who our guests are on our panel on this day. Let me introduce to you the Ben Kishan Sharma. He is the General Director of the United Service Institution of India, longtime veteran journalist who's good enough to join us on this day. Thank you, sir,
for being with us.
And somebody I've had a chance to meet with and share some ideas with since I've been here at Valdai, Professor Audrey Shushensov. He is the Dean of the School of International Relations of MGIMO, which is in Moscow, one of the most respected schools of international relations, not just in this part of the world, but in the entire globe. Thank you, Professor, for being with
us. Thank you for this invitation. We had a nice talk on Monday.
We did, and now we get to do it again.
Yeah.
Thank you. And but this time without dinner, unless someone brings us something that surprises me. And, of course, Carlos Ron is the former vice minister from Venezuela. He's also now a member of the Tricontinental Institute. Thank you, my friend, for being here.
You're very good? Glad to be here, yes.
So let's start with this conversation. I didn't intend for us to have a conversation about the aggressive language that's going back and forth between different people in Europe, some of which seem to be big proponents of going to war with Russia. I seemed myself, Professor, aghast when I heard this comment from Mr. Wallace, the former Secretary of State of Defense for the UK. What is your reaction to it as a Russian and as an intellectual, which you are?
Well, I will probably start with not that much of intellectual characteristic. In Russian, we have a term for such people, "zbitый lётчик," a plane crash pilot, a pilot whose plane was crashed or has crashed, got hit. He was a leader, a British leader, during the time when the West expected Ukraine to win a war. And he was behind the effort that assisted Ukraine in this military preparation. He assisted in military planning, intelligence gathering, planning all of the Ukrainian assets during the year 2022, 2023. Then his government collapsed. Boris Johnson famously got ousted from British politics for some time, hopefully. And these people are now trying to build a legacy about, speaking of Ukraine as a victorious power. For some reason, they still believe that this endeavor can be successful. But it's absolutely clear for everybody that Russia would not lose a war on its border, particularly when its vital interest is at stake.
Well, even facts aside, right? The facts are not on his side of the argument, just given the situation between Ukraine and Russia right now. But the audacity to say that we need tomorrow to blow up the bridge that connects Russia with Crimea, we need to start attacking Crimea. He's talking about full-out war, is he not? Am I crazy? That's what I'm hearing him say.
Well, the fact that he is not a, you know, an acting minister makes this word a kind of a bubble.
Yeah.
Russia, of course, would not react to the words of a, you know, simple expert who is speaking, you know, somewhere in Warsaw. For some reason, he has bad luck with Russia. His career got collapsed. And why do we need to react to him? But I would point your attention to this fact that it's very hard to sell war to Europeans currently.
Hmm.
And this makes all those speeches so exaltated.
You know, do you agree with me that while he's saying it's hard to sell war to the Europeans, all I hear from Europeans is war, war, war? Am I crazy?
Yes, of course. And
I'm hearing it from Macron. I'm hearing it from Starmer. So, I'm hearing it from Merz. They're Europeans.
See, what I think is the typical colonial itch, or what you call is a colonial hangover. You know, you're so divorced from ground realities that here you have the largest nuclear power in the world, that's the United States of America. And its core strategic interests are being undermined by encroaching upon its buffer. And you think that they will just sit tight and accept this rhetoric just for nothing? I think I will say the fall guy are the people who are really been victimized by, you know, propagating this kind of rhetoric is the innocent people of Ukraine.
Mm.
It's high time that the people of Ukraine, they introspect, they see what's good for them and what's bad for them, and do not bite this kind of a bullet and stick.
You know why? It seems to me, Carlos, and the professor knows much more about this than I do, obviously, but it seems to me like the people of Ukraine are not asked for their opinion on this war in Ukraine.
Well, probably, I mean, people are usually not asked about their opinion on war. And if you ask people's opinion, they're against war, most of the world. I mean, I think that what we see here is the reflection of how dangerous an organization like NATO has become. I mean, right now, the global North, or the collective West, whichever way you want to call it,
yeah,
is responsible for 74% of the military spending of the whole world. And that's because we've been talking about multipolarity this whole week. I mean, that part of the rise of or the need for multipolarity is precisely to stop this advance of a war culture. Because and I'm pretty sure the peoples around the world, the global South, everywhere else, you know, people want peace. They want to live in peace. It's just a group of special interests that are guided by this, you know, massive military spending that want to continue war throughout
the
world.
So you agree with me that these are the people who are pushing this down the throats of the Ukrainian people. Do you agree, Andre?
Well, I would use this comparison. During the Cold War, when the same leaders were on a different side, were opponents of Soviet Union, they were speaking in much calmer voice. And they were very much, you know, conscientious about what is happening. They understood the gravity of the threat that was in the middle of Europe. Soviet tank armies, Western tank armies were facing each other, you know, during the all of the time. And everybody understood that uncareful wording can trigger major crisis in the continent. And the way that they are expressing themselves currently implies that they don't believe that the major war can happen, because they basically provoke, you know, they use kind of a lexic that doesn't fit.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what you just said in reference to, I think all four of us were there yesterday with Mr. Lavrov, right?
Yeah,
you guys were there with Mr. Lavrov? I found his discussion yesterday. He spoke with us for about an hour and a half. And talk about a diplomat who embodies your exact words, what you just said. It's extremely important to pay attention, not just to what your words say, but what they denote as well, and what they connote. In other words, what will people draw as a meaning from what you say? I got a feeling listening to him yesterday. Some people think he's boring. I don't think he's boring. I think he's very exact. He's very, very exact. I find Russians in general tend to be very exact with their language. We Americans are just the opposite, Professor. And sometimes that kind of thing can get you in trouble. The Europeans are being footloose and fancy-free with their language lately. That can be dangerous. I think Orban's right. Do you not agree?
Well, I totally agree with you. You see, the point here is, if we put this whole argument of winning a war in Ukraine on the touchstone of reality, right from the beginning, the whole NATO rallied behind Ukraine. And they started and they said, we are winning this war, we are winning this war, we are winning this war. Then they tom-tommed about the summer offensive, right? Which did not even make a headway. Then they tom-tommed about Kursk counteroffensive. It did not make a headway. On the contrary, what the ground realities are, the Russians are virtually 20% part of the territory is under Russian control. There is already a referendum in four provinces. They've been included in the Constitution of India. Russians virtually have a control over Sea of Azov and the Black Sea, and they can turn the tap on or off what moves out of Odisha and what doesn't move out of Odisha, right? That's the military control that the Russians have been able to exercise.
Yeah.
Why isn't West realizing that? They are not even on the same page.
Let me ask you this. Why has India realized that? Why is India lately the biggest proponent and cheerleader of Russia?
No, so we have realized it right from the beginning. If you see Indian professional readings of military, we had predicted this war the way it has actually panned out.
Really?
Right in the beginning, we said that, well, Russia's initial strategy of maximalist strategy was not very cohesive for the reason that the thrust lines were not complementarity, the logistics are not keeping, you know, pace with the military pincers and things like that. But Russians were very quick to adapt. And from that initial setback that they had, they pivoted to northeast, then they pivoted to east, and they know exactly now what their military objectives are and how do these military objectives coalesce with their broad political objectives.
You know, my friend Doug McGregor and my friend Scott Ritter both have told me on this show and in other places on occasions that the world will look to what the Russians are doing in this war as use it in the future, both strategically and technologically, for how wars will be fought. That ground is being broken from a military standpoint, from a technological military standpoint during this war right now. And it's mostly the Russians who are leading that. Do you agree with that assessment?
It's not only Russians believe that, you know, we have the top military technology currently. Even our adversaries describe Ukrainian crisis and Russian military thinking as the top-tier military thinking. Actually, the strategy that is implemented in this crisis.
But you didn't go in with it. You've developed it as a result of the need that arose from the war. My words, not yours. Tell me if I'm full of crap.
No, I would agree with this and what General have just said, that Russia is very quick to adapt. And also, Russia has a great experience of using all of the instruments of its strategy, including military one. But it's a combination, you see, not only a battlefield that is matter, it also a diplomatic battlefield, an economic battlefield, ideological battlefield. And all of the sets of these arenas, Russia waging its strategy on all of these arenas, is very spectacular. And I think that you can hardly find a country that would, survive a very tough attack that the West has oriented it in the 2022.
So, you know, I'm going to agree with Zelensky then. Mr. Zelensky recently said, the strong man of Ukraine, notice I failed to call him the president of Ukraine because he hasn't been elected. But anyway, he recently said to Europeans, Carlos, you guys need us to continue fighting this war because we are on the front lines and learning how to combat Russia, something you may have to do in the future. So because we are the only ones close to Russia's technology, maybe not as good, but close to it, you need us to continue this war so you can learn from us. Those are not exactly his words, but he came pretty close from saying that. Is he right?
Look, I think there's a lot of imagination, to say the least, in what he, but, and there's something that he's in there. He has shown that he's in there also for his own personal profit.
Well, he's hanging on to anything to keep the war going, it seems to me. But in this case, when he says that, there is some merit to what he's saying. They are, I mean, you have to give the Ukrainians credit. They have fought a good fight, you know? Look, am I wrong?
No, see, the first thing is they're same people, Slavic people. They've been part of Soviet Union, right? So they're sort of way of war fighting is very similar to that of Russia. Let's face facts.
Huh.
But I would like to raise a larger issue, and that's the morality of war. Is this war a moral war or it is not? If somebody, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, is expanding NATO after giving assurances that, well, NATO will have no locus standi.
Yeah.
You have abrogation of ABM treaty. You walk out of the INF treaty. Then you start having the sort of the very heartland joining NATO. You have series of color revolutions in and around the periphery of Russia. How do you see Russia responding, right?
Yeah.
So you have, at every occasion, you have trampled the Russian red lines, and yet you expect Russia to just sit tight and do nothing.
Yeah, but you understand that. There's so many... Look, here's a guy who grew up in New Jersey, right? You talk to your friends in New Jersey, and I mean, Jersey's like perfect, typical America, right? Mm. You talk to a guy in New Jersey right now, and you say to him what the professor said, he thinks he's speaking Greek. He's not gonna buy in. To him, it's like, no, the Russians invaded some poor country that had nothing to do with it. They don't understand the provocation. That's the battle from an information standpoint that Russia and the multipolar world has to deal with, no?
Yeah, of course. And that's and I mean, that's the whole issue. I mean, the control of the narrative that the West has precisely, in, for example, inside the United States, so the way they, you know, they portray things in completely out of context without considering, you know, the legitimate reasons for the Russia has to, you know, to be concerned about its security issues. But then I think that's exactly what we have to move away from. We have to find a way to counter those narratives with bringing, you know, showing the true side of this issue.
You know, it's funny because you guys in Venezuela are going through a similar situation now. I mean, I think it's a provocation, obviously. The people of Venezuela are out on the streets protesting right now because they fear, or they've been told by their government, that at any day now, the United States might actually attack them because, well, Mr. Trump has actually uttered words close to that. How concerning is that?
It's a concern because we know what the United States has been doing for the last 200 years in Latin America. I mean, there's a whole history of constant intervention of all types. Invasions, taking, you know, promoting coup d'etats. There's a whole different a set of actions, and so we know they're capable of. But at the same time, you know, Venezuela, for example, is a country that like other countries in this case. You mentioned Ukraine, but you know, Venezuela is a country that's rich in oil. I mean, it has the largest oil reserves in the world.
Yeah.
And this is part of the needs of this war machine that keeps going and all over the place. I mean, at the end of the day, everything's connected.
We were talking about with the professor, or I mean, with the journalist about India and its relationship with Russia, which really have become very warm of recent. What is the relationship between Russia and Venezuela?
We have a very good relationship.
How good?
Very good. We signed last night as the strategic agreement between the two countries was signed, was approved in the Venezuela's National Assembly. And this is a 10-year strategic agreement in different areas, security, energy. It's been a good cooperation.
Is it good enough countries that you feel like if tomorrow the United States became aggressive in Venezuela, the expectation would be on Russia to in some way come to the defense?
Well, I don't like to get into hypotheticals of that sort because I think, you know, that's we got to be responsible with those outlooks. I mean, at the end of the day, we count on what Venezuela has, but I think
you're not going to let me push you on that, huh?
No, I'll tell you something though. I mean, and I think it's important. I mean, Russia has been very, very strongly stated, you know, their position on that Venezuela's sovereignty must be respected, that this aggression on Venezuela,
they have,
both in sanctions, both in this military movement, should not happen. And that's something that we appreciate because, again, like Russia and like many other countries in the global south, we believe in that there should be a respect for the international law and that we believe in the UN Charter. And, you know, we are part of a group of countries that are a group of friends of the UN Charter that are trying to uphold that international law.
Andre, what is Russia's newfound role in the world based on the fact that it has been the linchpin, which when castigated as badly as any country can be castigated by the West recently, sanctions, SWIFT, freezing assets, selling the assets, et cetera, et cetera. The world have seen Russia stand up to the big bad wolf and somehow survive. And now because it survived standing up to the big bad wolf, everybody looks at it as kind of the leader of this movement. My words again, not yours. Does that put Russia in an interesting place where it now has to be kind of a defender of a country like Venezuela, taking on onslaught of the United States, for example?
Russia is a great balance in international relations currently. Since the middle of the 90s, when Yevgeny Primakov was the foreign minister of Russia, it has been developing an idea of multipolarity. And this multipolarity concept is not aimed against West, against the United States. It's just a type of philosophy, a worldview, that sees any major power having a gravity of its own. And you cannot, you know, diminish the gravity power of China, of India, of Russia by any means. Sanctions, military threats, proxy wars, coups around this country. Multipolarity means that eventually the world will return into this balanced state. And in this perspective, it's very historically rooted. A historicism in Russian foreign policy is very vivid. And I think you enjoyed yesterday's remark by Sergei Lavrov, who is very much, you know, he thinks in a cause and consequence.
Cause and effect.
Causal effects, yeah. Historically rooted. And he describes the narrative of Russian strategy, you know, really resonates with a lot of countries.
What did you think yesterday when he discussed in specifics about Mr. Putin's decision not to go along with the first offer that was given to him in Alaska by Mr. Trump, vis-a-vis, I guess, the Europeans and Mr. Zelensky? And then he said, this is Mr. Putin talking to us yesterday, I'm sorry, Mr. Lavrov talking to us yesterday, and he said that Mr. Putin came back and then said, you know what, I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to go along with this, and we're willing to do this deal or come very close to doing this deal right away. All I'm asking for is the following. Remove the existing Ukrainian troops that are in the Donbas. Agree to that, and I think we can have a deal. And then Mr. Lavrov said to us yesterday, we waited and waited and got no response. But they were this close, if that would have happened, it seemed to me, from his description, to having a deal. Did you read it that way?
Well, I will not disclose the full response of Sergei Lavrov at the closed-door meetings that we had yesterday. But...
Oh, it was closed door.
But what I would decipher from his other talks is that Russia is showing very great goodwill about finishing this crisis by political means, diplomatic means. And basically what Russia sacrifices in this political proposal, it sacrifices the continuous of this war fighting and eventual getting more of Ukraine inside Russia. And that is absolutely clear perspective if Ukraine would now reject the peace proposal that Russia has.
Wait, let me stop you for a minute to make sure our viewers understand exactly what you just said. You're saying if Russia's not demands, but points, deal points, are not at least respected or considered, Russia has no alternative but to continue moving on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
On to Odessa.
Well, who knows? Who knows? But Ukraine, what should Ukraine understand about itself? It should stop being an instrument of the West in trying to diminish Russia's power. Because Ukraine is basically selling its sovereignty to Great Britain, to Warsaw, to the United States, to anybody who pays, basically. And Zelensky stated...
To use Russia's word, selling its neutrality.
Not only neutrality...
Because that's the word that we keep hearing from Lavrov and from Mr. Putin.
Well, you know, if you put yourself into the position of the leader of Ukraine currently and make this leader a state-oriented leader... Let us preserve Ukraine and its borders and its population and its history and its, you know, in its future. The best solution this person would decide is to get a peace deal right now. Because the next peace deal that Russia would propose would be worse than what is currently on the table.
Yeah. I mean, I would think that's the case, right?
See, I'll slightly take a different view on this. I think this Ukraine conflict is symptomatic of a larger problem, and that is the balance of power. You know, because the hegemony of America is shrinking, and like it was said in one of the sessions, when a declining power you know, it is losing its control. It becomes little, it goes haywire. Ah. It goes little berserk. And that's exactly what we have seen. You see the number of places where United States of America had military reverses. So much so, even in Afghanistan, were just more than a couple of 100,000 people. But they had to move lock, stock, and barrel from there. What I see that Russians totally do not trust America or Trump. You can't take him for his word, right? Similarly, you can't trust...
Does India trust him?
No, of course, you know, what we say, the proof of pudding is in eating it. the mere fact that we are beneficiaries of 50% yes. tariffs. So right. it states a lot. Mm-hmm. And they didn't trust us, and so we didn't trust us. It's exactly the same thing. Now, what I feel that subsequently, even if there is a truce, so to say, this tug of war in the gray zone is likely to continue for the time being.
Really?
It is not going to peter out and suddenly, you know, the devils will turn angels and it'll be all very nice hunky-dory, you know. I think this war is going to prolong in one form or the other. Maybe there'll be less bloodshed and less firing of missiles and drones. But the asymmetric nature of warfare, the gray zone, is likely to sort of persist.
You guys agree with that? You don't think this thing is going to be able to get wrapped up anytime soon?
Well, I think I'm up to, you know, the professor saying that I think it's true that there is a whole... moving towards more militarization and more—it's something telling of the times we're living in.
Why is there more militarization?
Well, I think because when the United States, which leads at the end of the day, you know, it's a force behind NATO, it's a force behind the issue in Ukraine. The United States has been losing its hegemony in around the world. You know, I mean, that what it thought it had. Consolidated since the end of the Cold War. Now, when it's faced with realities that it no longer controls, the technological development, when it faces that, you know, there's a new atmosphere for a different type of financial system or at least creating alternatives like BRICS, it starts to, the new empire
you're describing the caged animal effect.
Exactly.
The caged animal effect is the animal all of a sudden is in a corner, he doesn't know which to go, and that's when he becomes the most dangerous.
But and what makes it even more dangerous is that the one thing they do have that still is strong with them is military power. So see, that's what they're going to exert.
I disagree with you. You know what I think it is? Money. That's it. Nothing else. I think the people who are screaming into Mr. Trump's ears and telling him, let's support Ukraine, send more bombs to Bibi. All of these people are people who have bought the Congress had bought the Senate, and they make money every time we drop a bomb and every time a plane crashes.
But you're relating to two things. I mean, it's bombs are, you know, there's money in bombs.
Who's right here? I mean, I'm trying to look for your help. Professor?
Russian perspective is that you need to have a responsible statecraft to govern the world, to be a global power, to be part of multipolarity. A responsible statecraft means that you do not manipulate, you do not provoke, you do not put other countries into an awkward position that would essentially, you know, move them to respond in a military way. And we would like to see more constructive United States, a United States that understands what is the cause and sequence effect in international relations. And
the United States be a negotiator in the war with Ukraine when the United States is actually one of the parties that's at war with Russia?
You put me in an awkward position currently because I would like to say yes, but of course we all understand what the United States is playing, with whom and at what side. What Donald Trump is doing, he tries to get out of political risks of losing this war. Try to brand this war as not a Trump war, a Biden war.
Right.
He tries not to lose financial benefits of this war. He tries to sell weapons to Ukraine.
Yes.
He also tries to have all the options available. That is his, you know, lifestyle, negotiation style. He writes about it and tells it about in his interviews. And he tries to have a better strategic situation that he had prior to him coming into office. But the open question is, does he understand the reality of the process of the Ukraine crisis? Because it diminishes the, you know, American potential in Europe also. It diminishes American potential in Middle East. After Israel's strike on Qatar, United States had to make another official statement about that every strike on next strike on Qatar would mean a strike against the United States. So this means that having an American military base on your territory doesn't mean anything. So your sovereignty can't be hit by anybody else.
See, there's another angle to this. See, Americans resorted to this doctrine of preemption, and it has actually outstretched them very badly. Today, there are three fronts on which they are, you know, engaged. You have the Eastern European front, where things are not going in their favor. You have the West Asian front, where, you know, Iran has also dug in its heels and despite, you know, sanctions and whatnot. And now you have another elephant in the room, and that is the Western Pacific crisis. You virtually lost your, you know, your marbles as far as South China Sea is concerned.
Correct.
And now you have a big problem at your hands, and that is Taiwan crisis. Now, if
and all, threats on Venezuela.
And yes, and the Venezuela. So on all continents, you actually burnt your fingers, and you now want to retract. So there may be an incentive to look for a dignified exit as far as Ukraine is concerned.
Interesting.
The question is whether he's able to bring the European onto the same table or not. I don't understand what is the European problem, because most of their perceptions are totally flawed in terms of Russia now going and attacking Baltics or going to Moldova and some other countries. Mm-hmm. Russia is not looking like that. It's a very responsible and restrained power. How we are going to pacify this perception in European Union, I think the circumstances are going to take better of them. You look at the economies. The best economy today is growing at 1.8%. Mm. And there are economies like Germany, who was supposed to be a golden boy of Europe, is into minus.
Yeah, minus
two. So sooner or later, this economic fatigue is going to wear down on Europe, and probably that would be a good incentive for them.
But when you have a political system in Europe where the people are not elected as representatives of the people, most of them, the EU, for example, is appointed. NATO chief is appointed. And Macron is at 23%. Starmer's at 23%. Macron is at 29%. Merz's at 35%. And all of them are going down. And it doesn't seem to matter that the people don't like them or want them. They stay in power. What the hell kind of democracy is that? I'm not sure I understand that. Do you get it? Because I don't get it.
Well, I don't understand that definition of democracy. We have a very different one, and we are often accused of not being democratic.
You're communist.
Oh well, you know, I think we're a Bolivarian socialist revolution.
But you've heard the accusation.
But of course, and many other things.
Yeah.
That's probably the least of the accusations. But I think, that's a true and important point, because when you see in the streets of Europe that you don't see people wanting to go to war with Russia or any other war.
Right.
I mean, right now we're in a moment in time where the world is coming out of the streets. The peoples are going out of the streets for different places.
For different
against
reasons.
War, yeah. but especially against war. I mean, we have the whole Gaza genocide that's going on.
Yes,
and you see the massive. Even in Germany, we were speaking about this the other day. You know, this is how important it was. 150,000 people out in the streets in Germany protesting war in Gaza. But it's the same people that don't want war in Europe. That don't. We stopped. Somehow we lost the ability to talk about peace, about the necessity for peace. And only concentrate on war, war, and war.
People who are talking against the war, and people at the same time who are in the next breath are wondering, Why is it inflation for me is up? Why are my wages down? And why do I have all these immigrants living around me and I don't even know how to pronounce their names? That's a true situation for the people of Europe at this point in time. And their leaders are saying, don't worry, we're going to start another war somewhere and that's going to solve everything. Am I overstating this? But because that seems to be the case.
I would add to this characteristic is a major European problem is that it's not a confederation. It's not, you know,
monolith.
It's not monolith. It's like United States, like India, like Russia, like China. And they lost this opportunity of building a confederation in the early 90s, where they actually could have built it in the Western Europe without Eastern Europe. And now they created European Union for the sake of prosperity, you know, living a good life, having fun. And now these Brussels guys, they try to reinterpret European Union as a confederation and as a military bloc without having enough resources and political power to do it. And that's why I would expect them to be that, you know, exaltated, agitated. It's very hard to sell war to a population that have trouble, economic troubles. For Spain, for example, what Ukraine crisis means. It's nothing. Much more in the list of priorities is the situation in Palestine.
Do you think most Europeans know or understand or even consider the fact that the Russians were provoked into this situation in Ukraine?
We actually had a research on this. We tried to figure out what is the General Assembly of United Nations votes in the situation of a question, who is to blame for this crisis? If you put a diet, who is to blame, Russia or Ukraine? Most of the countries tend to blame Russia. But if you put a diet, who is to blame, Russia or West? Most of the countries blame West for what is happening. And that is, I think, very particular.
Was that a poll? Is that research that was done?
It was a research that we done at NGIMO University. Yeah. Yes, and I think it's very characteristic of the situation.
No. By the results?
No. What do you think, General?
No, I totally agree. And you see, from the pattern of voting in the UN itself on Ukraine war, you know, most of the countries of Global South, there's a hands-off kind of an approach, right? I mean, countries which are very close to strategically United States of America, you had a hands-off kind of an approach. So many people I see, well, people are not very happy that innocent people are dying in Ukraine. There are nearly 11 million people who have been either internally or externally displaced. It's not a good sign. But then the major question is that who provoked this war, you know? Why was there this itch for expansion of NATO and reinforcing the Eastern theater of NATO, right, knocking at the doors of St. Petersburg, right? And I think even as late as, I think, December 22, Mr. Putin just said, give me certain security guarantees and I will not use a force. And there was a perception in Russia that this period between 2014 till this offensive took place, they walked back on Minsk 1 and Minsk 2, whatever guarantees were made, and they used this period for building up phobia against Russia, Russophobia within the population, and try to build up the capacity of Ukraine army to go for a preemptive offensive towards Donbass. Now, this was the threat perception which was in Russia, and that is why perhaps they felt the need for going for this offensive.
And I think that's generally accepted by most of the people who are students of this particular crisis, that, in fact, there was a large provocation that Russia would have been happy to allow Ukraine to continue as it was, as a neutral country. But the moment it was being coaxed to become not neutral and to become, in fact, an anti-Russia state, that's when Russia had to put its foot in the ground and say, no, we just cannot stand by and allow this to happen, notwithstanding the fact that they were doing military exercises in the Black Sea and getting ready to put, no, not getting ready, actually putting NATO's military hardware in Ukraine with essentially, as some would say, missiles pointed at Moscow. Yeah, so obviously Russia had to do something. Now, was it necessary to actually start this military operation? That's a question for people smarter than me. I do want to end with this, though, this discussion. I mentioned at the beginning when I first started this program that even here at Valdai, there was some discussion early today in one of the seminars. I don't know if this is one that we're not to disclose or not disclose, but I'm a journalist, so I'm going to disclose it anyway. But there was some controversial remarks made because there's a question right now, really, for all of us in the world who are still looking at this is, what is the role of the United States? Is the United States in a weakened state right now because of all the conflagrations that you just mentioned and because of some of the things like Mr. Modi not even taking Mr. Trump's phone calls after the so-called 50% tariff threat. So one wonders, what is the state of the United States? And there was some controversy today from one official here who tended to speak for MAGA, self-determinatively, that, in fact, the U.S. position is stronger than it's ever been. There was a conversation around this center with people coming to me because I missed it. I had to do some work with my team. And they came to me and said, you should see what just happened, what was just said. Can you gentlemen speak to that a little bit, please, and make me better understand it or give me your reactions?
Well, there was an intervention, like you said, that was sort of a... It had a positive outlook on the state of the United States, but
good.
I have nothing wrong with that. Well, but you say that right after government has just shut down because of differences between the two parties, right after Trump has convened all of the military leaders of the United States to a meeting where he's basically declaring war on his own cities.
Hegseth, yes.
Saying he's gonna deploy. The military, and that the military should use the deployment in U.S. cities as a training ground. You're saying that you think you have there's a positive outlook for the United States when there's obviously a lot of economic effects of this tariff policy that are very questionable. I have to disagree with that perspective.
A lot of people here did. When we're not going to name names because it wouldn't be polite, but there were some people here, and this is a democracy here. It's called the Valdai Club, where different club members are allowed to express their opinions, and there have been some conflictive statements that have been made. And what you just expressed in disagreement with what that point that was raised is one that seems to be shared by a lot of people here. Do you share it?
Well, I would not state that the United States are now a diminished power that cannot affect international relations. Of course, an exaggeration.
And I don't think you're saying that.
No, I'm not saying that.
The United States is still very active, militarily very important, financial sense is very, very important. But I think that strategically, the United States have lost several decades on doing strategically wrong things. Spending a lot of resources, material resources, political resources on irrelevant goals. Why do you democratize Greater Middle East, what they called it, and spent several $3 trillion without achieving, a strategic result. And then shifting priority constantly to Europe, then again to something else. And I think this time could have been spent much better. And the system would probably be much more stable, and relations between Russia and the United States could have been much more predictable and stable. Eventually, what multipolarity implies, stable, predictable relations between powers that can actually hurt each other. That can hurt each other. And since they are threatened by one another, they understand that what kind of relations do we need to create to avoid these unnecessary threats? And this is what is the core of multipolarity.
Ben, I give you the last word. Were you there during this seminar this morning?
Yeah.
You heard the conversation?
I was there. But see, I'm of the opinion that we should not underestimate United States of America. It has the largest economy and largest military power. Only thing that I think this phase of Trump coming to the fore, I would say it's a huge aberration which has occurred in the history of United States of America. As long as there is a reflection and there is a course correction, and United States of America understands the limits of use of power, the hard power, right. And there is a recalibration and reset. And accepting this multipolarity due to redistribution of power today in the world as a reality and adjust to it, people will start respecting it all over again. Now, for that, you need a statesman. You need a sagacious leadership. And I think we'll have to wait and watch till Trump appears out of the scene and you have somebody else coming.
J.D. Vance?
But You know, so far, even his tone and tenor is not very dissimilar to what Mr. Trump is saying. At least, maybe he's not so impetuous.
Is that out of simply current necessity, but not in the long run, you think?
Well, maybe, perhaps when he starts wearing the crown, then perhaps his...
How Shakespearean of you. My goodness.
So his behavior may change for good.
Andre, do you agree? Have you read Mr. Vance's tone yet?
Well, I did.
You know, fine.
Russian perspective on this American political language is very constrained, because we understand that the United States is a very potent and powerful nation, but that has entered a number of global powers quite recently, only in 1945. Yeah. And they have not yet reached an experience of a mature global power that got hurt multiple times. When you got hurt multiple times, you speak softly, conscientiously, and you understand the consequences of your words. And I think that if the multipolarity is indeed coming, that experience is coming also.
Or as Theodore Roosevelt would say, speak slightly, but carry a big stick. Yeah. By the way, just as a point of reference, when the Iraq War broke out, I was assigned to the big stick, which is the USS Theodore Roosevelt, which is one of the biggest and most fashionable aircraft carriers in the U.S. fleet. I have to ask you this question only because of where the conversation's going. So I don't mean to make it terribly obvious, but I know because you're Venezuelan, I think I suspect what your answer is going to be. But J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, next president of the United States, go.
Look, I'm not going to predict elections here, especially in the United States, the way things are going.
This is a softball I'm throwing you.
No. I have to say one thing, though, that I think is important here. I think one of the big problems that has happened with this administration and in general terms is where they're getting their information towards how they create their policy. Because I think there's a lot of decisions that are being made with information that's not necessarily the correct information. I mean, the accusations now made against my country, against Venezuela, against my government, against my people, because this was a different moment where we're living. Mm-hmm. We're not only getting targeted as a country or as a government, but as a people. You know, there's persecutions inside the United States under the Alien Enemies Act on the Venezuelan people.
Who voted for Trump?
Well, some of them did. I mean, there's definitely a...
They love the guy, and now he's kicking them out.
There's about 120,000 U.S. citizens that have Venezuelan descent, and that most likely may have voted for him.
I'm not saying they deserve to be kicked out. I'm just saying it's a fact.
Well, but the issue is, they're taking decisions based on wrong information. And I think, or information that's not exactly. I mean, somebody that comes up and says that he wants to be the president of peace. They want to create peace. Well, he's exactly doing the wrong, the wrong decisions, again based on information that is flawed. And I think the problem that the U.S. is going to face in the next couple of years is that if the government keeps acting on flawed information, both in its foreign policy but also in its internal policy, there's going to be a lot of there's going to be dramatic tensions inside the country.
Okay. Gentlemen, this has been fantastic. What a great discussion. I really feel like we've really had a wonderful way of getting around many of the things that are going on in the world, and we've done it in a very flowing way, without too much interruptions, and in a great conversation, which has seemed very fluid to me. Thank you for being so genuine and so honest with your opinions, and for sharing so much of your wisdom with us. We very much appreciate that. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
No,
the pleasure is ours, of course. This is the Sanchez Effect. What we try to do on every given day is bring you this type of information. As you can see, nothing is written down, nothing is prepared, nothing has been prepared before we go on the air. We essentially talk based on the information that's available to us. We continue this on my podcast. It's called Journalistically Speaking. Give it a look if you'd like. Hundreds of thousands of people apparently have been joining that party. Oh, and then on X. My gosh, the conversations we've been having there this week have been tremendous. 500,000 people have already been commenting on many of the things that we've been commenting on here. And I'm sure many of you are going to be commenting on this conversation when we're done here as well. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thank you so much for being with us. And thank you so much, really, for letting us into your homes. We'll catch you next time.